I think these days as a law firm, we're not competing with the other law firm next door down the street. We're competing with the Amazons, the Southwest Airlines, the Ritz-Carltons of the world. I want every touch of my law firm to be a white glove, concierge level service. And so by creating this experience for clients, it's not just our marketing, you know, our word going out there. You've got satisfied clients who are spreading the word.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Answering Legal's Everything Except the Law podcast. I am your host, Nick Werker. If this is your first time tuning in, this is the podcast where we share expert advice on all the parts of running a law firm that attorneys weren't exactly trained for back in law school. Now, my guest today has had a really fascinating legal journey. He earned his law degree from Oxford University, spent time practicing as an English barrister, and in more recent years has become a highly acclaimed litigator in California. Now he's hoping to inspire some serious change in the legal profession with his new book, Unshackled, Reimagining the Practice of Law. We're going to be exploring this book on the show today, and Paul T. Llewellyn joins me now. Paul, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate
it. Great. Thanks for having me, Nick.
So I know that I listed a few things, but can you catch us up a bit on your law career, how you ended up moving from Oxford to Cali?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the reason I'm a litigator in California is actually the TV show LA Law. So I was growing up in England. It was this show. It first aired in the mid-1980s. It focused on the fictitious law firm McKenzie, Brackman, Cheney & Cusack. And justice was always served. Every case lasted one episode. You had the family lawyer, the criminal lawyer, the litigator. And it idealized the practice of law. So by age 10, I resigned myself to the fact I want to be a litigator in California. That's my dream job. So didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew what I wanted to do. And so then I studied law at Oxford. In England, you study law as an undergraduate degree. And then there was actually an LA law firm that had a program where they would take an Oxford law graduate to spend a year at their law firm in Los Angeles as a law clerk. So this, to me, it sounded like the dream opportunity. So I jumped at that chance and I absolutely loved it. I got to live LA law for a year. So then I went back, I became a barrister, which is the English equivalent of a trial lawyer, with the wigs, the gowns. And I was a criminal prosecutor for 2 or 3 years. And that was a great experience. I was trying cases every day, generally the equivalent of a US misdemeanor. Then I got a call 2001 from the same firm in LA. And they said, we've got an opening for a full-time associate. Would you like to come join us full-time? So the fact I'm here in California, you can tell what I decided to do. And so I took the California bar and I was with them for 6 years. And then 2007, I joined Latham & Watkins, which is California's largest law firm. So I got the big law experience. And then 11 years ago, myself and another Latham lawyer, Mark Lewis, we founded Lewis & Llewellyn. And we're now 18 attorneys practicing complex business litigation. And everyone is a former big law refugee.
When I was in undergrad, I think Suits on USA was either in like the third or fourth season. And I remember thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to be. You love the drama and you get caught up on it. And I was like, oh, I could definitely do what these guys do and memorize, because I could just read something and then spit it back out. I was like, oh, I'm going to be like that. I'm sort of grateful that I didn't. But then I ended up getting involved in the legal profession anyway, just in a much different role. So I was grateful for that. But you watched the TV show and then lived it.
I lived the dream. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's really cool. But I want to ask you about your book. So what should our listeners know about your book, Unshackled? And what was your inspiration behind writing it?
Yeah, so Unshackled, the book, it really looks at various areas of law, how we train lawyers, how we market ourselves, how we bill ourselves, how we treat each other, the legal system as a whole. So there's 8 or 9 chapters. Each chapter takes an area of the law. And basically, how can we do better? To a certain extent, it's a blueprint. As you know, so many lawyers, they're dissatisfied with the profession. there's alarming rates of dependency, you know, alcohol, drugs, tragically suicide. A lot of lawyers just hate their jobs. I personally, I love the job. I think I've got the best job in the world. I can't wait to get to work every morning. And I want every lawyer to feel the same way about their job that I feel. And that was really the, it had been in my mind for years. And finally, I decided to put pen to paper. And, you know, I don't profess to know all the answers. Of course not. But I at least wanted to start the conversation. As a profession, how can we do better? How can we treat our clients better? And how can we serve society better?
I love that. I do know too many people who went to law school, graduated, passed the bar, and then either decided that they don't want to practice law and went on to do. I have a friend who became a sports, what do you call it when you, when you're an agent for like a, for like professional athletes. I don't know what you, I guess that's what you call agent. It. Yeah. He's a sports agent.
Yep.
And I know a lot of people who got burnt out by the practice of law and left. So I'm actually very interested in this book because I think what we could do better is not only prep incoming lawyers for what life will be like, but also, I don't want to say weed out, but sort of like warn people, this is what you're getting yourself into. And then after that, you know, how can we do it better? So in your book, you detail how you believe the legal industry has sort of lost its way. What stands out to you as some of the, I don't want to say failures, what stands out to you as some of the legal industry's biggest shortcomings when it comes to this?
I think it starts with how we train lawyers, and it really starts at law school. So for a start, law school does, in my opinion, a terrible job in preparing people for the practice of law. At law school, you read these cases, you read these Supreme Court opinions, you'll debate the constitutionality of various laws. That's not what we do, or generally not what we do on a daily basis. You know, I look at most of my time, it's on the phone with clients. How do you deal with difficult clients? How do you deliver bad news to clients? It's talking strategy to my colleagues. It's how do we get clients? Ultimately, we're in the sales business. We're just selling our time. And so that is not taught at law school. How do you generate business? How do you get clients? And so I think for a start, we need to treat the practice of law what it is. It's a business. We're delivering a service. So I think it starts from there. Then as far as once someone passes the bar, in the US, you could pass the bar and then open your own law firm the very next day. Well, I wouldn't want a heart surgeon, you know, operating on me the day they get their medical license. Yet for some reason, as lawyers, we think that's acceptable. I'm a firm advocate of the English system, which I obviously grew up in. You have to go through a mandatory training program before you can appear in court, before you can service clients. As a barrister, it's called pupillage. And so for a year, you live the life of a senior barrister. You go with them to court every day. You work on their papers. It's a true mentorship program. And so some type of system before you just, you're let loose, I think some type of apprenticeship or training would behoove the profession. And then I think within law firms, I think obviously there's a emphasis on profits, like the AmLaw 100. How do they rank firms? So it's who is the most profitable? Well, maybe we need to think of other factors. Well, you know, what's associate satisfaction? What's their training programs? Are people leaving the profession? So again, I get that we're a business and there's always going to be an emphasis on profits. But again, that's not the only factor here. Are we delivering fulfilled lawyers? Are we delivering for our clients? So they're just some of the things I touch upon.
So you reminded me, I dabbled in pre-law. I went to multiple schools for multiple things, trying to figure out what I wanted to do in life. I was definitely interested in pre-law, but I have never... So I went to business school in the later years of my undergrad at Stony Brook University, which is very near where I live. And I had great professors, but I remember trying to get my business degree and having to take courses in management. And what was the one... It's about like emotional intelligence. I think it's called organizational behavior. I had to take a course in that. And I remember thinking, these things are so silly. This is not like real material that I'm learning. But in management, I learned how to control a room and give a speech and present. and work together in a team, which I thought, oh, people should already know how to do that. It's not true. And so I didn't realize that later in my life, these courses that I had taken would help me so immensely, like organizational behavior. How do I deal with somebody? How do I manage people? When somebody comes to me with a problem, how do I help them solve that problem rather than take it from them? And you know, how do I teach somebody how to do their job and train someone? And to me, I've never been in law school, but it sounds like they're not teaching any of that, which is kind of scary that you can pass the bar and then the next day open up a law firm and hire people and treat them according to what you already know, exactly. Which is nothing. Yeah. So this podcast, obviously, the name says it all. We focus on all the parts of running a law firm that law school doesn't prepare attorneys for. So what are some of the biggest things that you felt ill-prepared to handle during your initial years following law school? Now, I know you had like a mentorship where you were, but can you sort of speak to the difference between your experience and maybe what doesn't match up here?
Yeah, I think, so number one, I think what I call the business of law. I think, like I said, like running a law firm, opening a law firm, you know, like I said, how do you get clients? No one really teaches that. How do you service clients? How do you create a culture within the law firm? So culture is going to happen by design or not, but there will be a firm culture. So how can you lead from the front? How do you develop that team culture? What do you do when an ethical issue arises? And what do you do if a client's advocating a path that you disagree with? How do you deal with difficult clients? Sometimes you have to fire clients. How do you deal with that? I was fortunate in that both my English training and the firm I started with in LA, they were wonderful mentors. So I feel I was equipped with these tools because they were wonderful mentors. But so many lawyers, they just tell me, no, I was never taught this. I didn't know how to do it.
What would you say are some of the biggest changes that you would like to see or that you would implement as it pertains to the way that lawyers operate on a day-to-day basis?
So I've touched upon it. Number one, I think the apprenticeship, the training, how we train lawyers. We've already touched upon that. Another one, I think, is how we treat each other. I've heard many people say, I want an aggressive lawyer. I've never had anyone come to me and say, I want a mild-mannered litigator. Because litigation is by its very nature, you're in a dispute, you want to win. And I always correct clients and I say, look, I will employ aggressive tactics, but that doesn't mean I'm going to bang my fist and be aggressive. And I think a lot of people, they don't get there's a disconnect between the two. And I actually find it's better for clients if we treat each other with civility, with respect. Like I said, it doesn't mean you're going soft in litigation, you're going to suddenly lose. But actually, it's more productive. It's more cost effective for the clients. You're not having silly disputes. You know, so many people, they send these tomes, these long emails, like creating a record. I've been personally insulted. My education, what do you know? You didn't even go to law school here. And so personal attacks. You don't know what you're talking about. I've had the phone slammed on me. And, you know, like, why? It doesn't help. You know, we're not children here. So I think how we treat each other is key as well. And then I think the legal system itself, it's not popular, but putting money into the legal system, more judges, more law clerks, more resources, it's not a vanity project. It's not like a bridge, you know, that's going to win votes. It's always going to be a tough sell for a politician. You know, I know we need more money for the lawyers, more money for the legal system, but it's critical for the functioning of society. So even though it might not be politically popular, I think it's absolutely key for the efficient functioning of society.
I can't imagine getting an email that says, you don't know what you're talking about. And you're like, I went to Oxford, man. Like, you heard of Oxford before? But I understand what you're saying. So my brother is a terrible driver. And subsequently, he gets a lot of like, moving violations, speeding tickets, the red light camera tickets, you name it. And he's got, seriously, and he drives a truck for a living, which doesn't help. So he's got all these lawyers that do all these tickets in whatever counties that he gets. And I got a speeding ticket I don't know, I've mentioned it before. I think it was like 6 months ago now. I've never had a speeding ticket before. I get this ticket and I have a very good relationship with a local criminal lawyer, and I gave him the ticket and he handled it for me. And I remember it like came up in conversation. I was like, oh, I gave this to this attorney that I work with. And they were like, why would you give it to him? He's so mild mannered. He's too nice. He's too professional. Like, you need a pit bull. And I was like, why do I need somebody to go scream and yell? It's a moving violation. I want the guy to be eloquent and know what he's talking about. So I take your point, and that makes sense. But I do think that people have this idea that you need like, I don't know, like a Tony Soprano looking guy with a cigar and like the big wristwatch to go win your case for you.
Exactly.
I think that's a funny image in my head that I've got now.
And ultimately, as a litigator, like ultimately you're going to be presenting in front of a jury. Is a jury going to relate to that person necessarily? And so that's something to consider as well. Like ultimately you're just 12 members of the community you've got to relate to. And so again, is the Tony Sopranos type personality going to be someone that someone relates to? Probably not.
Listen, it's Long Island, man. I'm in Long Island, New York. So maybe.
Maybe.
So in your book, you write about how the legal profession is one of the least trusted in modern society, which I find interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about why you believe this public perception sort of exists and what lawyers can do to overcome it?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, we are set up for failure. I think, and TV, movies, is partly to blame for that. Like I said, I touched upon it, LA Law, you know, every case lasted one episode, justice is served. And I think the realities of litigation, the realities of the legal profession aren't always explored on TV. It wouldn't make for good TV. You know, when I tell clients how long litigation is going to take, how much it's going to cost, you know, look, you may, even though you did nothing wrong, you might want to consider a settlement here because ultimately you'll spend more in legal fees to clear your name. And so I think just the realities of the profession. And I think how the media portrays us often as greedy, filing frivolous lawsuits. I talk about it in the book, the classic example, the McDonald's coffee lawsuit. You know, the media portrayed it, oh, someone spills hot coffee over themselves and they get millions of dollars. That's crazy. The realities of that case were very different. You know, at the temperature, it was alleged that the temperature the coffee was served, it would cause burns within 2 to 3 seconds. And there'd be nearly 800 reports of serious burns in the preceding years. And the person didn't get millions of dollars. It was in 490,000 or 470,000. And she was in hospital for 8 days. She had burns over 16% of her body. Her physician testified some of the worst burns he's ever seen. But the media doesn't want to talk about that. It's not headline grabbing. You know, there's another urban legend. Someone trips over their toddler and then sues a department store. And it just didn't happen. It was just made up. And so I think, you know, so we're already fighting these perceptions. And also when people come to us, it's often at some of the most stressful times in their lives. They've been sued. They've been in a car accident. They're going through a divorce. A family member's died. They're going through probate. And so the fact they're coming to us in these times of struggle, these times of pressure again, it's almost like sets us up for failure. Most of the lawyers I know, they are, you know, hardworking, professional. They care deeply about their clients. But again, I think we're fighting this uphill battle. We're fighting this perception of the greedy lawyers who just care about the bottom line.
It's funny for me to hear that because I work with so many lawyers that I guess I'm just so used to you guys being normal. So I don't have that perception. But now that you phrase it like that, I do understand why people would see it that way.
It's funny, someone, one of the reviews of the book on Amazon, it said, I didn't realize lawyers are just regular people. Lawyers are people too. So I'm like, yes, we are. We don't walk on water. We are just regular people. But again, I think people often don't think of lawyers like that.
So. I think what was funny for me was, I think this happens with a lot of things too, is we see through the like media, television, movies, whatever, you see lawyers in a certain light and then you grow up and you don't really know anybody who's like a lawyer, maybe. And then you see your friends go out and become lawyers and graduate law school or like become a doctor, or I have a friend who just became a surgeon, and I'm like, I used to eat Cheetos and play video games with this guy, and he's going to operate on, he's a pediatric surgeon, and he's going to up. And I'm like, well, that's nuts. And so when you see somebody like fully go through that process, it humanizes it for you a little bit. But I do, like, if you don't have a lawyer in your life or you're not in the space, it could seem very intimidating through, I guess you're right. I watch SVU a lot, Law and Order. And it's, to me, I know it's dramatized. Like, it's just, I'm watching television. But if you don't know any better and you think that that's an accurate representation of how, like, prosecution is, then I see why you might be confused.
Exactly.
We will be right back after this short ad.
I felt like I always had to answer my calls, except the problem was you at times had to go to my voice message, which could potentially translate into losing clients. I've been utilizing Answering Legal for my firm since 2015. And truth be told, it was a game changer for me. I can be anywhere, and I'm getting my phones answered by Answering Legal. A strategic partner, as I call Answering Legal, provides a great reward. What is that reward? It's simple. It's time. Time with my family, time at the gym, time for whatever I want to do. I have a lot of Spanish-speaking clients, and it's such a joy to have them have the ability to call my firm and somebody on the other line is speaking their native language. They will not call me unless there's a new client, just to make sure that it's possible that that client can speak to me personally. As a private practitioner, I would highly recommend Answering Legal to other private practitioners. Now, every call goes answered.
I want to ask you this because I think that we throw around a lot of buzzwords in the legal industry or profession, and it's easy to just pretend that you know what you're talking about and just say yeah and use all the buzzwords, right? But I want to talk about making a law firm client centric and prioritizing the client experience, because I don't think a lot of lawyers actually know what that means, even though they want to do it. So. And they might not have the word for it, is what I'm saying. What do you think attorneys can do to improve the way that they serve and interact with their clients?
That's a good question. I think almost every single law firm says we put clients first. Something like that is on their website, every single law firm. But just saying it doesn't make it so. And I think these days, as a law firm, we're not competing with the other law firm next door down the street. We're competing with the Amazons, the Southwest Airlines, the Ritz-Carltons of the world. And I think the bar for lawyers is incredibly, incredibly low. It generally, again, we're not known for a profession for client service. And I think it's not just lip service, it's really everything we do evaluating how do we put client service first. I want every touch of my law firm to be a white glove, concierge level service. So what does that mean in reality? It means being responsive. If a client, it's amazing, someone emails me with a potential case. I've had potential clients, so I've reached out to several law firms. You're the first one who's even responded. You know, someone is potentially trying to give you business and you're just ignoring it, or they're calling the phone, no one returns their phone calls. So I'm always astounded by that. It means every interaction with me, setting clear expectations. It means being on time, being early to a Zoom. It means, have I answered your questions? It means not professing to know what you want. One of the first things I ever ask a client, a potential client, what are you looking to get out of this process? Some people say, I just want it to go away. I don't mind if I have to pay something. Other clients might say, no, money is no object. I want to clear my name. And so not professing to know what the client wants. I think managing client expectations. You know, clients are often shocked, at least in litigation, about 1% of civil cases actually go to trial. which means 99% will either be dismissed or settled somewhere along the way. So I think explaining the process to clients, meeting them at their level of sophistication, for a lot of people, they might be their first touch of the legal profession. And then I think afterwards, it's really, you know, often I'll have lunch or dinner with a client, or I'll call them up afterwards. Hey, just check in. How are you doing? And one of the advantages of that is I talk about in the book, I want them to be a member of my firm's cult. And that sounds, you think of cults, you think of religious fanatics. Apple's a cult. Why else would you camp out on a sidewalk overnight to get the newest phone? Nike is a cult. Again, why do people pay hundreds of dollars for the latest shoes? Being a member of the cult just means they're a fierce advocate of your firm. They're a huge fan. And so by creating this experience for clients, it's not just our marketing, you know, our word going out there. You've got satisfied clients who are spreading the word. So ultimately, it leads to more business. It leads to advocates for your firm.
I love the idea. So obviously, I speak to a lot of attorneys, most of whom are customers. And people will call me up, well, I need to do my social media better. Who do you know can do this? And I need to get a new website. And because my phone's not ringing, people aren't calling me. And I think people incorrectly diagnose why they might not be getting new clients or why their firm might not be attracting the type of clients that they want. So I want to ask you, because it seems to me like they definitely go hand in hand, marketing, your actual process of servicing a client. But in your opinion, where should lawyers start? Is it looking at their own internal processes or how does that tie into getting new clients?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, look at your internal team. I think, how do you treat each other? Because ultimately, it's not just you. You want every touch point in your firm, you want consistent service. And part of that goes hand in hand with treating your team members with respect. I talk about it in the book. I'll never refer to my secretary or my associate. Everyone is my colleague or my team member. Something's going on in their life. They're going on honeymoon. What can we do to make your life easier? How can we make sure you don't even have to think about work? You're sick. What can we take off your plate? It's your birthday. You know, what can we do to acknowledge that? We go once a year to a firm retreat. Last year we went to Scottsdale. We don't do boring meetings. It's just cocktails by the pool, top golf, you know, just hanging out. It was like going 25 friends for a weekend. This year we're going to Las Vegas. Again, it'll be the same. We just genuinely like hanging out with each other. So I think number one, it starts within. And then I think it's really just constant contact. I've heard it described, what works as far as getting business? The answer, everything and nothing. If it was that simple, just one thing, we'd all be doing it. Mm-hmm. But it's just being really delivering the highest quality client service, delivering results, and being just in constant contact. We do twice a year a big gift initiative. And I talk about this in the book, but it's, we don't send gifts at Christmas, because everyone sends gifts at Christmas. We send it typically April and September, October. Straight away, it puts us ahead of the crowd. And we agonize over these gifts. So, you know, what's useful to people? How's the box? How's the tissue paper? Everything, again, that's a touch point with our firm. And I've heard people say, I look forward to your gifts because it's you know, it's something different. The worst gift, I'm a big fan of John Rulin's book, it's called Giftology. The worst gift, yet so many law firms do it, a bottle of wine. And he said, the reason is if I give you a bottle of red, you might prefer white wine, or you might prefer gin or whiskey, or you might not drink. The chances of you drinking that bottle of wine and then thinking, gee, that was the best wine I've ever had, I'll remember it forever, infinitesimal. And so again, don't just do the rat race. Another pet peeve of mine is the e-holiday card. And you've got big law firms. You've literally got multi-billion dollar organizations sending out an email holiday card, just wishing you the best for the year ahead. Is that the best you can do? A multi-billion dollar organization, an e-card. I don't know about you, the last thing I want in life is another email. And yet they think they've nailed it. The holiday card, check, we've done it. So again, I think it's not following the status quo, not doing it just because everyone else is doing it, and really thinking outside the box.
My wife used to work for a promotional products company. And so I've been in charge of like sending out client gifts, and you're right. How do you choose? It's like, who wants pens, a t-shirt, a hat? Like, what do you send somebody? What's useful? But she made a living off of custom award. People get great. I'll tell you a funny one that sticks out in my head. There was a woman who ran her own company. I don't even remember what she did, but she had like 100 clients, and she sent them all like a crystal award with her face on it. And I remember I was like, can you make sure that they print an extra one so I can have one? And she's like, no, I'm not spending $50 on this thing so you can have one in our house. I don't want to look at this lady's face. But it's just, it's about your being genuine, thinking about what your customers actually want. They don't want an award of your face, right?
Exactly. So the gift we just sent out, it was an AirTag. And a customized luggage tag personalized with everyone's initials. So literally we send out hundreds of customized luggage tags. And the point was, look, with summer travel on the horizon, we hope you find this useful. And just the feedback, my God, that was so thoughtful. Thank you so much. John Rulin, we did this a couple of years ago. He said the best gift you can give, so the worst gift is wine, the best gift is a kitchen knife. And the point is, it is something you will use every day of your life. You'll think of the giver every time you use it. And it also is the kitchen involves people's family members as well. So if you can bring in people's family members. And so we did it one year. And again, the feedback was tremendous.
Giftology, John Ruland. I got to read that.
Yep.
I want to talk about this. You mentioned this earlier. And I've had a few conversations recently on this show about billing specifically.
Yep.
In the legal community, because everybody's talking about generative AI and how, you know, the billable hour is going away. So I know there's not a one size fits all approach, but what's your take on the type of billing system that you believe is most effective for law firms in general? Yeah.
So I think there isn't a single one. Again, in my first conversation with the clients, I'll typically say, what are you after here? The trouble with the billable hour is that it assumes every minute, every hour delivers the same value. It doesn't equate time to value. There's times where for example, I've written one letter, it took about an hour, and it saved a multi-million dollar merger. That delivered a tremendous amount of value. There's other times I'll be sitting in the deposition and my opponent is fumbling with exhibits, I'm not delivering so much value there. But the billable hour, it assumes that my time is worth the same. You wouldn't, for example, we've talked about the surgeon analogy. You know, if you needed heart surgery to save your life, you wouldn't say to the surgeon, what's your hourly rate? Oh, that's a half hour surgery, how much do I owe you? Of course not, they've literally saved your life. In that respect, you're paying for the decades of experience of that heart surgeon, the tremendous value that they're delivering. And so some clients prefer the billable hour, and we certainly offer that. Many of our clients like it, and so that's on our menu of options. Other clients prefer certainty in legal spend. So, for example, a fixed monthly fee to handle litigation. They can then budget for the year ahead. On the plaintiff side, a contingency fee. You know, where we take a percentage of the recovery. Mm-hmm. On the defense side, an early resolution success fee. Effectively, it's a bonus if we can get rid of the case quickly and thus long-term reduce legal spend. So I don't like the term alternative fee arrangements because it assumes the billable hour is the norm, is the proper one. I don't think it's going to go away, the billable hour, but I do think these other models will see a rise. And certainly as a firm, we offer a whole menu of options.
I like I don't think I've ever spoken to somebody who has all of the options I've ever heard of available to clients. So I do like thinking like, hey, how do you want to do this? How do you want to pay? You want to do it by a month? All right, let's pay by the month. You want results-based fees? We can do that. So kudos. This is a lofty question, but how will reading your book help lawyers to create a more fulfilling life working in the law?
I think it will hopefully cause some people to question, am I on the right path here? Am I truly fulfilled? Am I truly satisfied in what I'm doing? So for some people, it might be they really evaluate, you know what, is this the right firm for me? Do I have supportive colleagues? Am I doing the type of law I want? So for some people, it would be pressing pause on the conveyor belt and really thinking, am I doing what I want to do? For other people, it would be, why are we doing this? Why are we sending out e-cards or bottles of wine, or we only offer the billable hour? Or how am I treating my colleagues? How am I treating other lawyers? So really a period of self-reflection as well, I think. Am I contributing to the solution, or am I one of the causes of the problems here? And I think just beyond lawyers, to society as a whole, I think lifting the lid on the legal profession. I've heard certainly non-lawyers come to me and say, I didn't realize this was a real eye-opener. It was written in plain English. I didn't understand what it was really like to be a lawyer. So I think for other people, it's really providing a spotlight on what it's like, and for prospective lawyers as well. Again, this won't be taught you in law school, but this is the realities of the profession. Is this something that excites you, that you think, yes, I do want to go into it, or you know what, maybe I should reconsider a career?
So if our followers want to check out your book, where can they find it? And if they want to connect with you further, where can they go to do so?
So the book is available on Amazon, both in print and audible version. So they can buy a copy on Amazon. It's Unshackled, Reimagining the Practice of Law. And if they want to learn more about me and my firm, my firm website, lewislewellyn.com. And also there's a website for the book, unshackledlaw.com.
Did you do the reading for the Audible version?
I did not. The publisher recommended not to read it. And so I had interviews with various British voice actors. And then I picked one that sounds somewhat like me, but not the same.
So. I imagine that was a lot of fun.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Paul, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I want to give a special thank you to all of our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this conversation, and we will be back with another episode of Everything Except the Law soon. Be sure to check out previous episodes of the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Answering Legal YouTube channel. Links to everything covered in today's episode, including the link to the book and Paul Llewellyn's website, can be found in the description of this episode. We hope to see you next time, everyone.